Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're introducing you to a man affectionately known as Rev Kev, Kevin Johnson, who several decades ago was a pastor at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha. He is back this weekend for a special event of reconciliation, which you'll be learning about. In part two of today's program, we'll meet one of the musicians who's going to be performing Sunday afternoon at First United Methodist Church at their next Fine Arts at First concert. Stay with us. There is a very special homecoming that is occurring this weekend in Kenosha at First United Methodist Church. It is a special weekend of reconciliation in which this church, this congregation, I should say, is welcoming back a pastor who served that congregation for several years back in the late 1970s and early 1980s, and then was essentially dismissed from his position because of his sexual orientation. That departure, that painful departure, occurred way back in 1982. And all of these years later, the congregation has reached out to Pastor Kevin A. Johnson and invited him back for a moment of reconciliation, and he has gratefully accepted that invitation. And I'm very, very pleased to be able to be speaking for the next few minutes with Pastor Johnson, who now makes his home someplace very warm out in California. Do I remember it's Palm Springs, Pastor Johnson?
Palm Springs, California, you bet. Come visit.
Overseeing something called Bloom in the Desert Ministries, which is affiliated with the UCC Church. That's the United Church of Christ. And we will be exploring Pastor Johnson's story and talking a little bit about what he expects this coming weekend is going to bring. Pastor Kevin Johnson, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's great to be there.
So glad to be talking to you. Let's find out a little bit about who you are beyond this particular story, which will, of course, focus our most of our time and energy today. I know that you were born in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Tell us about whatever is interesting about your childhood growing up in Eau Claire.
You bet. I grew up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, went to college there at UWEC, graduated with a degree in as a teacher in speech and theater, but then just 10 days later went into a United Methodist Seminary in Dayton, Ohio, and, you know, spent time there. That's the furthest south I had ever lived in my life. The fact that the snow was gone in April was shocking to me, and it was a good experience. And then I was called appointed to be the associate pastor at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha there. I understand from a story that the people coming in, the minister there, had asked his brother, who was on the board of ordained ministry, who would be a good candidate. And the guy surfaced my name, and so I was kind of chosen to come to Kenosha. And so I flew to Kenosha and interviewed and got the job for $9,660 a year.
did I catch that was essentially your first call, or did you have?
Yeah, it was my very first. Well, I had been a student associate pastor of a church in Piqua, Ohio, for 2 years prior to that, and before that, I had been a Boy Scout camp chaplain up at Camp Phillips. Now it's a scout reservation, but Camp Phillips up near Rice Lake, Wisconsin, for about 5 years prior to that.
Okay.
So I'd been doing things in ministry for several years prior to coming to Kenosha, but it was my first official job.
Right.
And, you know, in my career.
So
and was the go ahead.
I was just going to ask if we had known you as a young person growing up, I mean, for instance, as a junior high student or a high school student, Would we have seen this in your future? That is, at that young age, was the church important to you? And did you sort of have future pastor kind of printed on your chest?
Well, it apparently was sort of the opposite because, I mean, I'd been very active at Eau Claire Memorial High School. I was never in student government, but very active in choral organizations and actually had visited Kenosha once early in, you know, during high school when our Memorial Concert Choir sang at, is it Tremper?
Yes.
What's the high school name?
Yeah, it's one of them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there. We sang there. I had to go to a Boy Scout event that weekend, and so I got on a Greyhound bus at the Kenosha bus station and rode back up to Eau Claire in order to go to my Boy Scout event that particular weekend. But what my other student, when I did say I was going to be a minister, sort of thought about it late in my senior year in high school, I really felt the call. I felt a presence and a call to go into ministry, and most of my schoolmates basically would say, "You're going to be a minister?" And so I don't think of myself as having been much of a party animal or that, but to them it seemed to be somewhat of a surprise. And then I, followed that through college, but my mother said that I needed to have something to fall back on, so that's why I got a teaching degree, in case this whole ministry thing never worked out.
Was there something in particular about the thought of being a minister that was especially appealing to you? I mean, when you said you kind of felt the call or felt a tug in that direction, what was it about being a minister that was appealing to you or intriguing to you at that point in time?
I would say it, it is a feeling. I mean, I had grown up in the church and at Lake Street United Methodist Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and was very much a part of it. And it was a part of my social core and a part of my life. I said it took me 4.5 years to do college because I was doing church as well as college and a job. And when I went to seminary, I did it in 2.5 years instead of 3 because my job became the church. So there was something within me, and that had that sort of calling. I totally, there were ministers that I admired greatly. I would think of Reverend Perry Saito, a Japanese minister who came and had to live through the reactions of World War II veterans in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, when the Japanese minister came to the Methodist Church. I remember Art Hurley, the youth minister, who was so great in helping me with a better understanding of biblical, historical critical approaches to the Bible. And I remember Reverend Tom Jarrell, who was the senior minister when we were there, and I admired him a great deal. So, there would be role models that I think were inspiring, but then also I felt the presence of Jesus in my life, and and I went through what would be considered by some a born-again experience when I was in college, and now I know that that's more accurately understood to be born from above, but we don't need to get into that on public radio. And it was a beginning of my spiritual development, and the calling into ministry was something that was important to me. I'd been told at one time that one of my great-grandfather was a traveling lay preacher, and my great-grandmother played the organ going around Buffalo County, Wisconsin, being the Methodist presence there. But I don't know that there's anything genetic about it.
At that point in time, and I suppose you could talk about since too, what did you regard as your own gifts for ministry? I mean, what were gifts and talents that you had that you thought or other people thought would equip you well for such work?
The interesting to note that my mother told me that when the fuel oil delivery guy would come to our house in Eau Claire, Wisconsin in the middle of the winter and come in to get paid or give the bill or something like that, he often said of me as a young child that by evidently my loudness that I would be either an auctioneer or a preacher. So the preacher thing is what worked out. So I guess there's an aspect of talking, which hopefully I'm not ruining in your show, and also the aspect of I'm trying to think. You know, there is an element of teaching, some aspect of just having a sense of the presence of God and trusting in that. That I would, you know, basically being able to trust God's presence in the midst of many different situations. And maybe that's it.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with the Reverend Kevin Johnson. I understand you go sometimes by the nickname of Rev Kev.
And yeah, I got that nickname in Kenosha.
Ah.
And one of my youth group kids at a pool party when I was first there just yelled out, "Hey, Rev Kev," and that stuck.
So Pastor Johnson served First United Methodist Church from roughly 1979 to 1982, and he is being invited back this weekend for and a weekend of reconciliation, as it is being described, a weekend which will include an event on Saturday to which the public is welcome to attend, in which he's going to be talking about his experiences. This brings us to something we've not yet talked about, only briefly mentioned, and the fact is that you lost your position with First United Methodist in 1982, because of your sexual orientation, because you were gay. Explain to our listeners, first of all, if you don't mind talking about it, at what point in your life you, in a sense, became fully aware of your sexual orientation. At what point did that happen in your life?
Well, I will tell people, you know, that date this sort of thing, that I came out when I was 27 years old. But looking back, I can see that I was gay from just very early self-awareness. And, you know, there are situations and instances among family and friends that I remember even as a child and as a youth where I experienced them as both affirming and also experiences situations that were belittling. So I started to get societal clues about who I was when I would, I'll say innocently, say something that was probably not understood to be like what was ordinarily understood to be heard, and I would get pushback, or in other situations I would get, you know, affirmation. So it was early, but, you know, there were no good role models. I talked earlier about role models for ministry, and as far as being an adult gay man, you know, at that time, and there were very few role models, and certainly not in the public life. It was just the beginning of the time when, like, Harvey Milk was coming on the scene, and then he was shot and killed. So obviously that didn't turn out well for him. And, you know, that was in the news when I was in Kenosha. So societal pressures basically hid from me the role models until I had lived enough of life to be able to start discovering them for myself. And, you know, while in youth and as a young adult I dated women, that just did not work, and it wasn't what I felt, you know, authentically on the inside. It was, and I don't want to say that any of my relationships were, you know, shams. It's just that they weren't complete. They didn't have the same fullness that I did when eventually I was able to establish relationships with you know, people, you know, with men. The thing about it also, you know, and at the age of 27 is when I say I made friends with myself as a gay man. And I came to a good self-understanding, and I did that by clearly working it through for myself, doing the work, as they say in psychological or social work situations. I did the work biblically and spiritually and socially and realized that it was right for me to have the identity as a gay man.
And go ahead.
Well, I always, you know, it was a wonderful feeling, and to realize that I was neither alone nor wrong in my life. And at the same time, I knew that there were church laws that were not in my favor as a gay man, but as a fully ordained elder in the United Methodist Church, I had what, you know, professors in universities call, you know, I had something like tenure that people have in a university. All the church laws were on my side, even though I knew that societally there wasn't all that support. But I still knew that there was risk. But so you know, in my situation like that, I came out while I was in Kenosha. And I made a pledge to myself that I wasn't going to make any proclamations, but I would not lie. And so what, you know, while there, I had a small circle of friends that I trusted enough to be able to speak with. I didn't do that in a big, broad way, but then just basically, you know, for lack of a better phrase, one person who I thought I could trust but couldn't be trusted with the truth, asked me, and I answered truthfully, and that's when the implosion began there at the corner of 60th and Sheridan.
I'd like to know a little more about, just ahead of talking specifically about that, what the process was like for you in terms of coming out to a circle of friends, and I assume to your family at that point as well, or did they already know? And what was that process like? I mean, sometimes people hear really heartbreaking stories about how this kind of announcement leads to doors shutting in your face and ties being cut and all kinds of things. And it can be a moment of immense pain. Did you experience much of that in coming out?
Well, so the two particular areas would be, one, in developing a circle of friends, I connected with some people in Kenosha through social circumstances and did have, you know, some friends there, as well as there were a couple of other people who were my, for lack of a better word, classmates, you know, in the clergy, who I was able to speak with. And I did also have the support and confidence of my district superintendent at the time. I did not say anything ahead of time to, like, the pastor that was there, and I had not said anything to my family. So when I came out to my family, I had to, because there was the possibility there was going to be news from Kenosha appearing in the papers. And so I called my parents and told them, and just so happened I needed to drive up to the northern Wisconsin anyway, so I for a church trip, and so then I just took a few days and went over and spent time with my parents, and we kind of came to a detente or a rapprochement, but it was never, and it was an embrace of me personally, but never an understanding fully of who I was as a gay person. They came from a different era, and there just was not able to be a complete connection, other, but it was not a cutoff. And then I called my sister and told her at the same time, and that situation never quite resolved itself. And so while we are in communication with one another more now than we ever have been, it's been stilted and distant for, you know, ever since.
Right.
And again, I just feel like it's a different era. My sister was born before World War II, and I was born after World War II. And I just think it's you know, well, one, experientially, you know, I have a different truth. And secondly, it is unfortunate that that's not the case. And the funny thing about that, and, you know, I don't mean to say anything too personal, but, you know, my sister left the Methodist Church to marry a Catholic man who left the Catholic Church, and they both became Episcopalian as a compromise type thing, and have been very active and wonderful participants in the Episcopal Church, you know, throughout their entire marriage. And at that time, my sister even got hate mail, you know, for her wedding. And I was always wondering why she wasn't able to equate the discrimination she experienced when she got married to the kind of religious discrimination that I faced, but it just, you know, weren't able to connect those dots.
Wow. When you were sharing this about yourself with a relatively small circle of friends, which, as it turns out, as you said yourself, wasn't quite small enough, in that you did ultimately share this with someone who, in a sense, sort of went with that information in a way that was unfortunate for you. What did you think about as you thought about who to share this information with? What kinds of things did you ponder about whether or not a given person could be trusted to know this about you?
Yeah. I tried to sense the spirit of the situation. I know that when this person asked me a question in the privacy of my office there at the church building, it basically said something like, I want to ask you a question about this, and then I also want to ask you if you're gay. So I said, what I did is I said, well, I'll answer your first question first. And I proceeded to answer that question, and then I did say to him, yes, I am, and here's how I have an understanding of how it works and what is, you know, basically good about it. You know, that I tried to sense the spirit of the situation. But that was very, I had no experience in that sort of thing. And so I know now and counsel other people in similar situations differently based upon my experience. And I think you have to be really careful about, you know, who you talk with. There are some situations where people are activists, and so therefore they are out there with the proclamation. And then there are other people who really have to see themselves as part of what, you know, the equivalent of the French resistance in World War II, where you have to be yourself and be your life, but you can't be totally open because it would be devastating to you and your life. And so I totally understand that that is still the case. There are people that have to be a part of the resistance, and they can't be totally open. And you've got to be able to judge that and be very, very careful about it, because not everybody can handle the truth.
I assume that none of the young people to whom you were ministering knew this about you, that none of them were part of this small circle of people to whom you shared this about yourself.
No, not at all. So when the situation unfolded in Kenosha, I did meet with the youth group and told them that I was gay and I was having to leave, as well as the other staff members and that sort of thing. But no, that was not a part of it. I mean, while it would seem scandalous that a minister, you know, comes out and they discover it, in the reality of the situation, it was scandal-free, because there was nothing along those lines. And I tried to, so in essence, to be, you know, in 1982, that was a huge situation of unfinished business. And one of the things that's interesting is, like, there's going to be a youth group reunion. I don't know who's going to be there, and I'll probably be crying the whole time. But the deal is that, and I get a little choked up even now talking about it, because the kids were left adrift, and they had nothing to explain reality to them, and you know of what was going on. And my understanding, I've actually been contacted by a couple of the kids now, because this news has come out and they've heard it, you know, in Kenosha, and people are calling their relatives in Arizona and doing this and that and saying, guess what's happening? And I've been contacted by Facebook on, you know, by a couple of youth, you know, who are now adults and have had families of their own. And I get the word that it was so mysterious, and that, you know, that it felt mysterious and just completely unfinished and up in the air, and that they basically have had this bit of unfinished business in their lives ever since.
Hmm.
I think of that as part of the harm that the institutional church does on yet a continuing basis.
Hmm. Can you just say a quick word about the circumstances under which you essentially had to depart? You shared this information with somebody who did what with that information?
Yeah, the TikTok on that is that that person spoke to other people, word spread, the senior minister learned of it. The senior minister called the district superintendent. The district superintendent confirmed that he knew. The district superintendent and the senior minister called a meeting of me and the pastor parish committee leader and the DS and the four of us sat in the senior minister's office. They asked me a question. I affirmed myself fully, And as a result of that, there was a regularly scheduled meeting of the Pastor Parish Committee coming up soon, I think like that week, if I remember correctly. We had that meeting, went into it. It was total brand new news to the people that were there, the nine people that were there. Some of them had never dealt with anything like this ever before in their life. And in that meeting, despite statements by me and the DS and the senior minister that, you know, I'm the same person I was before, you know, not to get into all of that, but, you know, we can probably do something with this. They asked the clergy to leave the room, and the committee met, and when we went back in, I often say I felt like I was going from the offices to the factory floor. You could just hear that something had to be done. And the committee decided that I needed to be gone by the end of the year. This meeting actually took place in October, and that I had to be gone by December 31st. And then, you know, we get into the Byzantine aspect of how things happened in the Methodist Church. And that all got delayed so that I was still in town in April. But after December 31st, I was being paid, but I was told I could not come into the building. And then I went on, as of March 31st, I wrote a letter and said I would go on what then was called leave of absence, and I moved to Chicago. There also was in the background playing two things. One, there had been a minister in Denver, had moved from a half-time appointment to another part-time appointment, and the bishop out there had made that happen successfully, and it was in the news and all this sort of thing. And we in Wisconsin had the first woman bishop in the history of the Christian Church, and Bishop Matthews wanted to make it work where I would go from full-time to full-time. They couldn't make that work. So I basically sat waiting for the appointment system to work, and it didn't work. And then we started hearing rumblings from conservative groups that if it did work, they were going to make it a big fuss. And I didn't want my grandmother reading about this in the paper. And so I said, you know, this is not my burning bush. I'm not the Moses of this situation. And so I will go on leave of absence. And I moved to Chicago and started life as a business person for the next 20 years.
I read that in the biography that is on your church's website. And I kind of wondered what those 20 years were like for you. And what did it, I mean, what sort of pain was involved in that and having to divert your life so dramatically? And yet, on the other hand, were you able to find fulfillment in those two decades that you found yourself in the business world?
Well, if you define fulfillment by, you know, making a living, I was able to do that. It was apparent to me throughout that time that I was not called to be a business leader. I was able to do it because I could do sales. I was always in some sort of sales job, but I always had to make my own way. You know, whether it was 100% commission or I was responsible for the sales and marketing of a department, you know, I always had to make my own way. It's too bad I couldn't get some nice cushy government job, but it just never worked out that way. The fact of the matter is I didn't go to church for almost 10 years. It was too painful. I would go to Fourth Presbyterian on Michigan Avenue and sit in the very back row of the top balcony, the furthest away I could be, as well as the easiest escape. I would arrive a minute after it started and leave a minute before it got over. And I would go because I felt continually still in relationship to God and Jesus, but I had to basically endure the experience of church. And whenever they talked about loving everyone, I would say, accept me or accept gay people. And that was very clear. It took about 10 years for me to be able to even experience my anger or rage. I was in shock. Some people, I'll just call it shock. I was in continual shock for 10 years. And then I did preach. I preached for the first time after 10 years, got my robe out, put it back on, put on a stole, and preached at Broadway United Methodist Church in Chicago. And that felt good, but I couldn't sustain it. I wasn't strong enough. And it wasn't until 1999, when the Reverend Greg Dell was brought to trial for doing a Holy Union, that my boyfriend at the time, who is now my husband, and I woke up in the morning of the day when his trial had been announced, and Fred Phelps was going to be there, and there were 2,000 people outside the Broadway Church, and the news was all there, and all this sort of fuss was going on, that I said to my to Mike, my now husband, and said, "You want to go to church with me? I see that my brother is in trouble. He thinks the system is going to work for him, and I know it won't, but I need to be with him and give him support." And so we went, and that was the first start of our going back to church in 1999 all the time. And that eventually led to being the place where I felt comfortable enough to experience the vision of returning to pastoral ministry, and did so in 2002.
How much do you see this journey that you have experienced as a very tangible and important influence on the kind of pastor that you are? I mean, the fact that you have experienced what you have, what sort of role does that play in the kind of minister that you are and the sort of ministry that you do?
The point that I would make is that as a result of my experience, I understand very clearly what it is when people talk about the two feet of the Christian walk are compassion and justice. That whenever, you know, as Marcus Borg, the author, talks about, the real word for holy is compassion, and the real word for righteousness is justice. So compassion and justice are the most important things, in my mind, of the Christian walk. And so they are what are the core of the ministry that I, you know, try to live. So, you know, I'm probably, thought to be maybe even too welcoming. But, you know, our desire is to welcome all who welcome all. And, you know, we don't have to get so caught up in particular aspects of religious dogma or doctrine. If we're talking about compassion and justice and relating that to the ministry of Jesus, then that's the kind of Christian that I am. And that's how I'm able to function. I hope that I have an empathy, empathy, because I went through a whole lot of stuff. And so, therefore, I want to be as available as I can be to other people when they're going through their stuff.
So tell us about the experience of receiving this invitation from this congregation, which you had to leave under such painful circumstances such a long time ago. First of all, did you have any inkling that this was a possibility ahead of receiving the first sort of official word?
Inkling before, ahead of the official word, yes, because the minister prior to the minister now had contacted me to say, the congregation is going through this reconciling process. You are still an important part of this congregation's history. I wonder if you might be open to, you know, coming back if we are able to complete this. And there had been a couple of other situations where there were like anniversaries or occasions where it would have been appropriate for me to come back and visit. But I did not feel it was right, even though in one case I did send a letter because I loved the person they were celebrating very much. But it just didn't feel right to me to go back physically, even though, and so when this invitation came through after the reconciling process was done, I had said at the time, you know, I'll come back, but, you know, my husband has to come with me. You know, I need to be in this situation, you know, fully who I am, and we need to fully understand what has been gone on. And this is not just a, you know, cover over anything, or, you know, we're not just trying to paint anything with broad brush. We need to totally understand what has happened, and then be able to move into the future for good. And when the invitation came, they said, that's what we want to do. We want you and your husband to come and, you know, expenses paid and spend time with us. And what would you like to do? And I talked about various aspects, and in collaboration with their reconciling committee, we were able to work out the details of what are going to happen over the weekend.
Was there an iota of hesitation on your part?
Well, of course, from the standpoint of, you know, how much am I going to be able to cry, and how much, you know, will I be choked up? And, you know, it's going to be, I believe it's going to be a tearful time. At the same time, I think it's a healthy thing, and it's a time for healing, as, you know, the reconciliation process is bringing two aspects that were separated together for good, you know, bringing them together for the purposes of doing good, and that's what I believe will happen. So once we're to this point, no, and I am, you know, fully ready to go. I just know that there are some things that may be a little scary, and I'm willing to, you know, trust God and go through that.
A last question, and it's a tough one, and also it brings up matters that we're not really supposed to be exploring in any detail here, but let me pose the question anyway. I am sure there are people listening to our conversation today who view all of this very, very differently than you do, and my question is, how do you envision or imagine conversations and dialogue occurring between those who see this in the way that you do, and others who read the very same Bible and come to very, very different conclusions about what it means to be gay and what should be allowed for a gay person to do, and so on. And again, without us debating the theology and right. the vast divide there,
right.
I'm really just asking you about the sake of sort of conversation and approaching this topic, and how you would have us think about some of these really, really divisive issues, and this is just one of them.
Sure. I know that based on experience and teaching and learning over the years, that for me, there are a couple of overriding factors. One, this is an issue that can be very emotionally based. And people, when you are trying to talk about things from an emotional perspective, conclusions that are reached from an emotional understanding are not able to be changed. Minds are not able to be changed with some sort of factual or logical kind of understanding. It has to be an emotional connection. So people have got to learn through relationships as well as their own spiritual journey where they can come down on this in a way that is oriented toward compassion and justice rather than a way that is oriented toward fear or disgust. And in doing that, that's one way that they can come to their own understanding. I already have done that, and so I don't need to get caught up in their emotional journey. Secondly, there are factors that come into play that are just understanding of the history of the church. And from the very beginning in the Christian church, there were differences of opinion about how things work. And so the Paul of the ancient days that is so often used to put down gay folks by some of the things that he allegedly wrote in his letters, he was at odds with the church in Jerusalem. And in the middle of that also was Peter floating around there. So Paul, Peter, and James, the brother of Jesus, who was in charge of the church in Jerusalem, did not agree on particular matters, and each of them, in some ways, went on their own way. So it is possible that our church can be different from your church, and our understanding can be different, and we can still be Christians together in some ways. So I understand that to be a part, that kind of differentiation to be a part of the Christian church from the very beginning. You don't hear about that in Sunday school, but that's something I've learned over the years.
Right.
And then there's just my personal experience. And, you know, Methodists are different than Lutherans and different than Catholics and different than Baptists. And, you know, and people that are liturgical are different than people that are Pentecostal. So there are these differences in the church, and so it is okay. So long as, you know, you understand that I'm coming from a place of integrity. I will do my best to receive you, but just don't try to make my life worse.
Well, Kevin Johnson, Reverend Kevin Johnson, I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you, and we want to remind people that First United Methodist Church welcomes you back for what they are calling a weekend of reconciliation. And for the public, there is a presentation that you're going to be giving at First United Methodist on Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock.
Right. They're calling that Keeping Faith. And I'm basically to expound along the lines of what we've been talking about.
Right. And you are also going to be back in the pulpit of First United Methodist for their worship services Sunday morning. Reverend Kevin Johnson, I have appreciated this opportunity to speak with you and to hear something of your story. I appreciate it, and I wish you well. Thank you again so much.
You bet. Thank you.
And the time is 9 minutes before 9 o'clock. This is WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. As it happens, this weekend is a very big weekend at First United Methodist in Kenosha, not only for their weekend of reconciliation, but also because it happens to be the next concert in the Fine Arts at First series. And Fine Arts at First is bringing to town a very, very exciting and innovative group by the name of Latitude 49. This is a small instrumental ensemble that specializes in new music, and as a matter of fact, they collaborate in all kinds of exciting ways. And I'm very, very excited to be able to speak for the next few minutes with pianist Janie Parsons, who is part of Latitude 49, performing Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at First United Methodist Church. And of course, as with all Fine Arts at First concerts, this will be free and open to the public. Janie Parsons, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm really, really excited to speak with you. And before I go any further, I have to ask you to explain the wonderful name Latitude 49. Probably a couple of our more geographically astute listeners will understand what that name refers to. But for everybody else, explain the name Latitude 49.
Sure. Well, you know, when we first formed, it's a six-member group. So we have piano, percussion, saxophone, clarinet, violin, and cello. And when we initially formed, we were all students at the University of Michigan, but it just so happened that three of the six were Canadian. I am one of those three. And three were American-born. And so we decided that that would be a really creative and exciting, fun way to kind of identify ourselves as, you know, three Canadians, three Americans, the 49th parallel. It forms the majority of the border between Canada and the U.S. And so, so we thought that was kind of an interesting title to show our identity, but also this idea of crossing borders and trying new things and kind of being a liaison between different worlds.
When was the group first formed?
We were formed 5 years ago. We formed at the University of Michigan when we were all students.
And is it still the same original six who comprised Latitude 49?
It's pretty close. We've had two members change. We had our clarinetist move back to Toronto, and so we have a new clarinetist with us now, and we also have a new cellist.
And the concert that you're going to be presenting on Sunday, I believe, is titled She. Explain
yes.
that title.
Well, you know, this is kind of a really exciting and fun program for us to present, because what we realized is that in our programming, just in trying to choose music that we love and that is exciting and we feel people would really want to hear, we realize that we program a lot of women composers end up on our programs. And this may seem like a normal thing to most people, but certainly in the classical world, it's not. And a lot of times what we see is there's a heavy leaning towards male composers, especially if you're playing traditional classical music. And so we just thought, why don't we celebrate the fact that there are so many wonderful composers out there that are women, that are writing music that is dynamic and really reflects our world. And so we decided we would put together a whole bunch of our favorites. Essentially, it's like Latitude Top Hits almost on this program. And we thought we'll just title it She to represent, the wide range of beautiful, beautiful works and works by women that we've come to love over the last 5 years.
Fantastic idea. I also love the title of your debut album, which I think has just been released. The title is Curious Minds, and I suppose that is a lovely embodiment of so much of what Latitude 49 is all about.
Yes, absolutely. That title came from one of the pieces on the album that's called Five-Note Chord, Seen from the Porch of a Curious Mind by a good friend of ours, Garrett Schumann. And we thought when we got that piece, that was such an innovative title, and we thought, so much of what we do is to try to open people's ears to new sounds, to new worlds, and really reflect the world that we live in, or reflect the world that we hope we can live in, with interesting sounds and real curiosity for what's happening in instrumental music today.
Tell us about what you think about as you go after new music, commission new pieces, and choose what you are going to play in terms of trying to figure out what will be meaningful for you and meaningful for audiences, because of course there's all kinds of limitless possibilities when it comes to brand new music. And how much do you think about trying to connect with audiences that are going to come to your concerts without a music degree or without much experience in contemporary music? I guess my question is maybe how far do you push the envelope and what things do you think about in terms of what music you will devote your time and energies to and share with the world?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. That's something that we've asked ourselves as well, because when you're in the classical music world, all of us are trained classical musicians. It can sometimes tend to be a little different world than the average person who, might come to a concert on Kenosha on a Sunday afternoon. And so it's important for us to think about how we present our music. And, that has been a real central part of Latitude 49's programming, is to try to really think about what an audience, what will draw an audience in, and what will actually appeal to people with 21st century ears that hear, everything on the radio from pop, rock, country, classical, NPR, anything. And we really want our music to represent today's listener. And even if it's a little bit on the fringe of what you would typically listen to, we try our best to choose music that that reflects our interests and also reflects really what we think is the leading music that's being written today in contemporary instrumental music. And then also a big part of what we do is to develop programs that are really interesting and have themes that kind of draw people in. So the She concert is part of that, in trying to find a sort of a unifying theme over a selection of pieces.
Pianist Janie Parsons is also the artistic director for this highly regarded group called Latitude 49. They come to First United Methodist Church this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock for the next concert in the series called Fine Arts at First. The public is welcome. There is no admission charge. And we remind you that Sunday afternoon's concert is titled She, devoted to intriguing new works by women composers. My thanks to Janie Parsons for joining me for part two of today's morning show here on WG.